Hello and welcome to Bright Wings, children's books to make the heart soar. I am your host, Charity Hill. The purpose of this conversation is to help mothers and fathers identify books that will liberate their children to embrace truth, goodness, and beauty. I thought, hey, St. Patrick's Day is coming up. Might as well do a podcast on Irish literature. I've been reading some Irish picture books and some Irish-related middle grade fiction. That'd be fun. But then I thought, well, how do I know what's Irish? What does it mean to be Irish? What are the features of Irish literature? What is distinctive about it? What sets it apart from English literature? I think here in the United States, there are plenty of Irish descendants who have a vague and foggy, mystical sense of what it means to be Irish that's hard to put into words. And so it's hard to name and to put your finger on exactly what makes this story an Irish story. But how do I go about talking to you about what makes this Irish children's literature Irish children's literature? How can I identify that? How can I put that into words? So I turned back to a marvelous book by Thomas Cahill called How the Irish Saved Civilization, the untold story of Ireland's heroic role from the fall of Rome to the rise of medieval Europe. What interests me in Thomas Cahill's How the Irish Saved Civilization is how it helped identify for me my observations about Irish literature. Cahill's book helped me say, hey, I'm not crazy, I'm really seeing something. It helped me discern what is distinctively Irish about Irish literature. So I will name for you what I saw in Irish literature. Then I will show you what Thomas Cahill has to say from his work, How the Irish Saved Civilization. I will describe what he sees, and then I'll share with you picture books and middle grade fiction works that I think are authentically Irish. So it was my perception that Irish literature is literature of so many paradoxes, that Irish literature is very comfortable with paradoxes, depicting paradoxes. One thing that was very clear is that there's often a juxtaposition of high and low, sometimes in one character. There's a juxtaposition of darkness and light. So, and there's also a strong presence of the weird in Irish literature. What do I mean by weird? I don't mean to criticize. I mean weird. I mean uncanny. You have these stories into which you're reading along and there is a world that seems like mine. It seems dependable. And into this dependable world pops a trick or an unexpected evil or trouble comes upon us. So also this sense of the weird is that we're going along in a world that seems bright and good, and then there's this mean face leering at me from behind a bush. And yet sometimes Irish literature demonstrates the opposite. It demonstrates a strong and fierce joy in nature, a gladness for the goodness of created things. It's really marked by that too. Also in Irish literature, in terms of characters, sometimes you'll see this sense of clannishness, loyalty, family, warmth, and friendliness, right? And then two more things seem to be features of Irish literature. One being a kind of a sense of democracy. We're all so close together, perhaps on this island, that nobody is really too high above me, unless really they are quite fine. But snobbery is not prized. And the last feature I noted in my observations was a sense of home and place. The whole place is like a small town. It might be small and rustic, but it isn't to be confused with anywhere else, so to speak. Now, I'm going to admit something odd. I've always had a kind of homesickness about Ireland, though I only lived there for 3 or 4 months already when I was in my 20s. But I remember feeling homesick for Ireland when I was a kid. Why not Italy? I love Italy. I love everything about Italy. But it was Ireland I felt this way about. Just so you know, this kind of homesickness is called hiraeth. It's a longing or a nostalgia for a place long gone, or even an unaccountable homesickness for a place you've never visited. Hiraeth is a real thing. It's just a bit of an odd thing. Now, you might be wondering, how can some of these things that seem to be opposites actually make sense? How can Irish literature really, the observations I've had about Irish literature, how can they all really be reconciled? I was wondering the same thing. And so it was wonderful to encounter Thomas Cahill's book, How the Irish Saved Civilization. So the point of Cahill's book is actually how this period in Irish history was a hinge for the whole world. He's talking about what happened in Ireland such that Ireland became a hinge for civilization from the fall of Rome to the rise of medieval Europe, a period of about 600 years from 400 or thereabouts when Patrick was first enslaved until about the year 1000. When Brian Boru defeats the Vikings decisively at the Battle of Clontarf. So he's asking, how did this happen? How did the Irish do this? What were the conditions that allowed this to happen? And while I think this is a distractingly interesting question, this is not the question I'm asking and answering today. I'm using Cahill's book to help me identify what is Irish. One of the arguments that Cahill makes along the way is that the features of the Irish personality, the features of the Irish character, are notably consistent through the ages. He even argues that the Christianization of Ireland around the time of St. Patrick came as a kind of fulfillment. And so there's a hermeneutic of continuity between pagan Ireland and Christian Ireland. Cahill thinks that nothing was lost in the Christianization of Ireland. In fact, there was a kind of flourishing, a kind of unification in the psyche of Ireland. So, Patrick, how did he do it? Right? We've already noted, Cahill says, his earlier earthiness and warmth. But these are qualities that make for a lowering of hostility and suspicion. Of themselves, they do not gain converts among the strong-willed. We can also be sure that the Irish found Patrick admirable according to their own highest standards. His courage, his refusal to be afraid of them, would have impressed them immediately. And as his mission lengthened into years and came to be seen clearly as a lifetime commitment, his steadfast loyalty and supernatural generosity must have moved them deeply. For he had transmuted their pagan virtues of loyalty, courage, and generosity into the Christian equivalents of faith, hope, and charity. But though this singular display of virtue might have made friends, it would not necessarily have won converts, at least not among a people as stubborn as the Irish. How did Patrick make this happen, Cahill wonders. And he notes that Patrick found a way to connect Christianity with the deepest concerns of the Irish. St. Patrick was able to connect Christianity to the Irish's highest ideals and their lowest impulses. The conscious Irish mind at the time valued a short life and a brave one, to quickly and easily and willingly give your life in battle. Cahill proposes that this also covered a deep subconscious fear of death that, quote, no public rhetoric could erase. Cahill continues, he writes that Patrick held out to these warrior children in his own person a living alternative. It is possible to be brave, to expect, quote, every day to be murdered, betrayed, enslaved, whatever may come my way, end quote, and yet be a man of peace and at peace, a man without sword or desire to harm, a man in whom the sharp fear of death has been smoothed away. For Patrick had, quote, put his himself in the hands of God Almighty. And do you remember when I was talking about seeing paradoxes in Irish literature? Cahill talks about how, quote, just as there was in the Irish psyche a cleft between conscious bravery and unconscious fear, so we can also discern other unconscious, subconscious dualities that give us excellent clues as to the true temper of this race of seemingly carefree warriors. Cahill talks about how the Irish believed in shapeshifters, the way that you and I believe in molecular stability. This shapeshifting, quote, was the ability of a being to turn itself into something else. But however wonderful this instability may have seemed to the conscious Irish imagination, it had its dark side as well, for it suggested subconsciously that reality had no predictable pattern, but was arbitrary and insubstantial. There was within this worldview a terrifying personal implication that I myself have no fixed identity, but I am like the rest of reality, essentially fluid and essentially inessential, end quote. So as I was telling my children at dinner last night about this belief in shape-shifting, my kids were totally creeped out. They didn't think it would be fun or cool. They thought it would totally destabilize their world that somebody could show up looking like me, but yet not be me. That's what shape-shifting would imply. The poor things were pretty creeped out by it. And that's exactly what Cahill is implying, that this meant that the Irish worldview, nothing was stable, nothing was reliably what it seemed, nothing was reliably good. You might be tricked, and Irish literature is full of trickery. Trickery that can't be avoided, and thus you fall to your doom. Quote, there is not a hero in ancient Irish literature who does not fall prey to some taboo or another. A gaish, the Irish called it, a word that may be translated as observance. From the Greeks, we remember Achilles' heel, his one bit of vulnerability which proves fatal to him. Oedipus's prophesied fate, which turns out to be inescapable, though he does everything he can to avoid it. But in the Irish stories, the traps seem to lie hidden at every crossroads, and trickster gods lurk behind each tree. How does Patrick face this instability, this mutability, this darkness, this reality that's laden with traps? Patrick could, quote, put himself imaginatively in the position of the Irish. To him, no less than to them, the world is full of magic. One can invoke the elements, the lights of heaven, the waves of the sea, the birds and the animals, and these will come to one's aid, as in the incantation, he calls it, of St. Patrick's breastplate, this prayer that Patrick wrote. Quote, the difference between Patrick's magic and the magic of the Druids is that in Patrick's world, all beings and events come from the hand of a good God who loves human beings and wishes them success. And though that success is of an ultimate kind, and therefore doesn't exclude suffering, all nature, indeed the whole of the created universe, conspires to mankind's good, teaching, succoring, and saving, end quote. So it's clear in Irish literature that reality can have its threats, that nature can have its troubles, and yet the deer is deep down freshness of things, as Hopkins says, is what reigns supreme. The goodness of created reality comes from the hand of a good God. And therefore, that joy that we see in Irish literature, that joy at creation, the joy at natural things, is totally perceivable. And we've got a good basis for it. That might be perhaps my favorite feature of Irish literature, is that it doesn't deny the darkness, but rather we see light pierce it. We see good subvert evil. We'll see it in The Prince of Ireland and The Three Magic Stallions, a picture book. So we see this juxtaposition of darkness and light, although in this case it's clear that the light shines in the darkness and the darkness hasn't overcome it. Patrick is totally confident in this goodness, that his God, who created all things, even things that have, quote, since become bent or gone bad, will deliver us, his children, from all evil. Our Father is not far away, but lives among us, for he created everything by his word, which was with him in the beginning, which became flesh in the human Jesus, and flames out, in the words of Hopkins, in all his creatures, end quote. Cahill tells us that we need to think further about these themes that I have observed in Irish literature of high and low, light and dark that are juxtaposed. That Patrick had to do this too, and that this is crucial for understanding the Irish people. When Patrick confronted them and their practice of human sacrifice, he suggests that there are two things going on psychologically. The low aspect is, don't pick me, pick him. And so the Irish sacrificed slaves and the infirm and the elderly. And depending on how you look at it, they also sacrificed infants for a good harvest. Cahill talks about how this manifests the psychological kind of low point where you say, oh, not me, pick that one, not me, but this one here. Don't take me, take this other one. And it's my understanding from what Cahill writes is that the Irish gods consumed these human victims. But Cahill suggests there's also something super noble in their practice of human sacrifice, which was, like I said before, depending on how you see it, the infant sacrifice could be, here, I give you my best. I give you what is most dear to me. I give you all that is special about me. And so it's also noted that they found a particular man they named Lindlow Man. He was found in a bog south of Manchester, and they think he might be Irish. He's a druidic prince. He's perfect. He's unblemished apart from his sacrificial death. from his kind of ritualized death. And it's possible he was even raised for such a moment, possibly, that he is their highest and their best. So you see, in the way that the Irish even practiced human sacrifice religiously, that that their lives and their existence was very determined by this like lowest common denominator and this hugely sort of aspirational dynamic, offering their best and their noblest. Into this culture whose life was really a religious life, Patrick comes saying, "I offer you a life where such sacrifices are no longer needed. I offer you a religion and a theology in which there is both the scapegoat, the one who says, I will be the one instead of you. Not me, but you, right? And I will also be the lamb, the unblemished lamb who takes away the sins of the world." Cahill writes, "Yes, the Irish would have said, here is a story that answers our deepest needs and answers them in a way so good that we could never have dared dream of it. We can put away our knives and abandon our altars. These are no longer required. The God of the three faces has given us his own son, and we are washed clean in the blood of the Lamb. God does not hate us. He loves us. Greater love than this no man has, than that he should lay down his life for his friends. That is what God's word made flesh did for us. From now on, we are all sacrifices, but without the shedding of blood. It is our lives, not our deaths, that this God wants." End quote. So this is the marvelous Irish paradox that the low and the high can coexist. And in this case, the incarnation, God becoming flesh, the low thing can conceal the high thing, or in this case, the high king. A prince, as we see, might be wearing rags, but in fact, he's the best of them all. Lovely paradoxes. So you see in Irish literature, it's okay to love the humble thing, because it might be right there where the glory of God is. Reality is no longer shape-shifting and unstable, but rather the instability is that at any moment, the common thing might flash forth the glory of God. Instead of being unstable, it's simply surprising. After Christianity, the pagan influences, their gods and their little evil creatures just really shrank in power and stature. In fact, they became so small that they became objects of laughter and mockery. The comical gargoyle who has lost his position in the world. The devil might still exist, but one thing he can't bear is to be laughed at. After Patrick and the Christianization of Ireland, one thing became clear is that they had ceased practicing slavery, which is astonishing. They were hundreds of years before the rest of the world in recognizing this. And so there's no wonder that I pick up on a sense of democracy within Irish literature. As to the sense of place, of Ireland being a very specific place, sort of very local and particular. And so Cahill notices that the Irish, because they never had to endure martyrdom, and yet they wanted to sort of, in a sense, distinguish themselves and go whole hog into Christianity. Since there was no martyrdom available in Ireland, one thing that they invented for themselves, they tasked themselves with, is the next hardest thing they could think of. Leaving Ireland was considered a hardship to such an extent that they compared it with martyrdom. And so they sent out their monks into the continent, into Europe, and founded new monastic communities that in turn became then universities. So the whole point I bring this up is to show that it's clear that the Irish really value where they're from. They have a strong sense of place, a strong connection to the land. And so no wonder we see the importance of place in the literature. And if you don't mind me making a private point about Ireland and place, it helps me make sense of my experience of Hiraeth, the sense of nostalgia for Ireland. To be Irish away from home is to have a kind of Hiraeth, and would only be done for the most noble cause. And then the second point to be made is that these monastic communities, which were flourishing centers for prayer and scholarship, accepted everyone, noble and poor. They housed and fed, gave books to, and taught everyone for free. Here we have the sense of high and low, all in one location, mixing, and that being distinctively Irish. We have a strong association with a kind of democracy with the Irish, their cultural values plus Christianity acting as a great equalizer. Now, this is just a simple children's literature podcast, and I am not an expert in Irish literature by any means. There was that class in undergrad, but that's it. But reading Cahill's book helps me identify this sense in Irish literature and of paradox, of the holy and the unholy, of the pagan being just returned back to its status as creation, and the nearness of the holy of God to creation. It helps to identify for me what is going on in literature when we see something dark happening, and yet there's still something pagan happening, and yet they're still kind of talking about God or Christianity or Christ or Mary, as if the story is taking place in this transitional period of light and dark, at this hinge point where evil needs to be bested. You get the sense from sort of the medieval period, but you can still get the sense in Irish literature that the realities present to our eyes right now are not all that there is, that there is kind of this secret magic permeating our situation, that the holy or perhaps the unholy might pop up at any moment, that really the world is charged with the grandeur of God, as Hopkins says. Now that I've given you a sense of what you're seeing when you read Irish literature, let's get into talking about specific works. In the picture book, The Prince of Ireland and the Three Magic Stallions by Bryce Milligan, you see some of this. You see this mix of kind of pagan things happening with some Christianity as part of the context. It's not an arbitrary world, and in the end, evil loses. But along the way, the Prince of Ireland has to undergo a kind of curse, a kind of Gaelish, one of these observances that's thrust upon you that you have to undertake and come through for the sake of honor. Of course, he does this cheerfully and handily, craftily, keeping the affection of his twin stepbrothers, who are supposed to be his enemies. He surmounts plenty of trickery and obstacles, but he can't help winning out in the end because he is charming and brave and tells good stories under pressure. Of course, in Irish fashion, he comes through and the community, you know, he meets with the great approval of his community. Another picture book in a similar vein is called The King of Ireland's Son by Brendan Behan, illustrated by one of my favorite illustrators, PJ Lynch. He also illustrated one called The Names Upon the Harp, Irish Myths and Legends. I have not read it, but I'm totally intrigued and I am probably going to order it. And if you get to it before I do, tell me what you think of it and tell me if you see what I see in Irish literature. That would be so fun. Another book I recommend looking into is called Once Upon a Place by Eowyn Colfer, also illustrated by P.J. Lynch. It contains 6 poems and 11 short stories, and each of them revolves around the theme of place. They're situated in or inspired by a particular location in Ireland. I can't recommend it because I haven't read it, but I'm just telling you it's out there. I do like that they're recently written. They're concerned with the theme of place, but I'm also concerned that one of the stories is scary. So there's your heads up. That's Once Upon a Place by A.N. Colfer. He's more famous for Artemis Fowl. On the theme of place, I can wholeheartedly recommend the trilogy by Hilda van Stockham, which begins with The Cottage at Bantry Bay, Francie on the Run, and ends with Pegeen. The setting of the story is crucial to the plot and to the development of the characters. We get an Irish family farm, and we get the sea and fishing throughout the course of the trilogy. The middle book, Francie on the Run, for reasons that are hard to explain, Francie is traveling all over the Irish countryside. And so you get really a sense of Ireland in this book, its geography, its hills, its land, the sea. Also, with a sense of belonging to a place, you get a sense of belonging to a people. There's such a strong sense of family in Hilda van Stockham's trilogy. Warmth, believable warmth, definitely believable mischief, but just kindness and good relationships overall. Strong characters, very realistically written, delightfully flawed characters, and dashed in with bits of Irish folklore and fairy tale. These books are really marvelous read-alouds. The warm sense of place and family come through in a book by Patricia Polacco called Fiona's Lace, a really meaningful story about a girl who's the lace making in her family is what brought her family together. And due to hard times, they emigrate to America, where they're almost like indentured servants. It's Fiona's lace making that, in fact, that gives them hope for climbing out of poverty. But Fiona's lace saves her family in another way. And you'll see that this book is a mix of low and high. And you'll see how the most beautiful things, the most noble things, shine through this family. If you belong to Well-Read Mom, heads up, I have questions regarding Fiona's lace in the family supplement. These are great discussion questions that really help you plumb the depths of this beautiful story with your child. One more picture book I love is called Prince Boghole. It's well-loved in the Hill family. Prince Boghole by Eric Christian Haugard, illustrated by Julie Downing. And the language of it, it's just written as if it's an oral tale you're listening to. I love it. King Desmond of Munster seeks a husband for his daughter, his only child, the Princess Orla. And, quote, since princes are as eager to become kings as grey singets are to be swans, soon there are three suitors in the castle, the elegant Prince of Leinster, with his splendidly dressed attendants, the Prince of Ulster, fierce and warlike, and the shabby young Prince Brian, who comes from a kingdom so small and poor that the servants of King Desmond laugh at him and call him Prince Boghole. The princess and her father cannot agree on a choice, and so the king proposes a contest. A marvelous story and just the best mix of high and low, all in one place. The king himself is in his socks with his feet propped up on a stool, and one of his socks, well, needs mending. The king we see is, well, fairly casual when he's at home without any guests to receive. And I love that Julie Downing, the illustrator, did this. There's a plate of chocolate chip cookies, just a wonderful anachronism that conveys casual. And the princess is sitting on the floor playing with her cat, while the king looks at her fondly with his head propped on his hand. The king learns some humility and wisdom along the way. Wonderfully, one of the people who helps see Princess Orla through this tricky situation, here we go, mix of high and low, is her nurse, Gormlai, who knows how to say a strong thing and walk away and leave it. For she knows, quote, that her back had won many an argument. It's a story of how can Princess Orla choose the man that she loves and still make a choice that all the kingdom respects. It's a situation full of pitfalls, but in the end, authenticity wins out. Courage, generosity, and cleverness subvert the pitfalls. The language in this book is so canny and cadenced, but the illustrations are just awesome. They really add depth to the story, and they really do help us see the high and the low in the king and in the kingdom. A nobility that coexists with humility. Yes, the illustrations really participate in telling the story. That's Prince Boghole by Eric Christian Haugard. Now, in no particular order, I have a few I want to recommend. Now, Tommy DePaula has three that come highly recommended. I really enjoyed Finn McCool, the Giant of Knockmany Hill. My friend Amanda Knapp, who's been on Bright Wings before, we both recommend DePaula's version of Patrick, Patron Saint of Ireland. And Amanda also enjoys Jamie O'Rourke and the Big Potato, an Irish folktale, also by Tommy DePaula. Those three are jolly good fun and pretty easy to find. I'm going to list all these books in the show notes because I'm not certain I'm going to be able to find them on bookshop.org, my bookshop on that website. And I want you to be able to look them up yourselves and find them. Do your best, please, to buy from ABE Books and Thrift Books to support some of these smaller sellers if you can manage to do that. I also want to let you know I'm including a number of titles for adults. They are nonfiction, but they're written as stories, the best kind of way to read history, in my opinion. They're not written like a novel. I guess I just mean that they're written in a really readable narrative fashion. So I hope you enjoy checking that out and finding something worth reading. Oh, one more thing. Last but not least, I highly recommend, we hugely enjoyed a radio play on the life of St. Patrick. It's called The Trials of St. Patrick, and it's produced by Augustine Institute Radio Theater. It's available through formed.org. I'll put a link in the show notes to make it easier to find. Really well done. Lots of different voices. A little intense at some points. They do mention human sacrifice very, very generally. It does convey a strong vision for the sea change in Ireland that happened with Patrick. It also manages to convey how humanly Patrick could desire, after escaping from slavery in Ireland, how he could desire to go back. This radio play made St. Patrick so much more tangible. I would recommend The Trials of St. Patrick for ages 7 and up, depending on your kid's sensitivity. I want to close with this delicious quote by Edmund Campion about the Irish. He was an Elizabethan Jesuit who was martyred at Tyburn in 1581. He writes of the Irish, quote, "The people are thus inclined, religious, frank, amorous, ireful, sufferable of pains infinite, very glorious, many sorcerers, excellent horsemen, delighted with wars, great almsgivers, surpassing in hospitality. They are sharp-witted, lovers of learning, capable of any study whereunto they bend themselves, constant in travail, adventurous, intractable, kind-hearted, secret in displeasure. Caelum non animum mutant qui trans mare curant. They change their sky, but not their soul, who cross the ocean." To St. Patrick and the Irish, slánchan.